Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Thursday, April 23rd, 2026 in the Gregorian calendar and the 6th of Iyar, 5786 in the Hebrew calendar. Today we have Binyamin Moalem with us to explain what it means that the ceasefire is extended. We'll cover regional changes and discuss the possibilities ahead since the U.S. is hosting unprecedented talks between Israel and Lebanese officials, countries that share a border but don't share diplomacy or positive relations. Now, let's get to the news. Binyamin Moalem is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. Having worked as a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel, he has a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin now devotes much of his time to curating and explaining current events and politics in Israel on his popular Instagram page, By Moalem, where he provides balanced news coverage from an Israeli perspective for those seeking to be informed without an extensive time investment. Binyamin has authored several thought-provoking featured op-eds and has been featured as a guest lecturer at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Let's bring him in. Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. We are here today with our political analyst, Binyamin Moalem. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We are coming out of the Yoms, as a friend of mine likes to call them. We had Yom HaShoah. Last week we had Holocaust Remembrance Day in Israel. Then we had Yom HaZikaron, the Remembrance Memorial Day. And then we had Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israel Independence Day. And here we are, reborn and not having missile alerts happening. So a lot of people here in Israel were expecting or wondering or thinking that we would wake up on Wednesday or maybe even Tuesday night going into Wednesday, that we'd be re-entering war with Iran because we had a fragile ceasefire.
That was set to expire Tuesday night between Tuesday and Wednesday.
That was set to expire between Tuesday and Wednesday. And a lot of people believed that we were going to be back in war. And so far we've had one day of quiet. So take us through, why are we not back in war after having a 2 week break with, we had one was 2 weeks and one was 10 days. We're in two ceasefires, right?
Well, the Iran ceasefire was originally for 2 weeks and the Lebanon ceasefire is for 10 days, which ends on Sunday.
Exactly. So we have some little windows of time where people are kind of, you know, I mean, you could actually tell me, have you been trying to enjoy your ceasefire and breathe a little bit?
I'm still watching the news all day.
Still watching the news all day.
But there's less to watch and less to cover. So, yes, I've been able to enjoy the downtime.
Well, for me, I have found myself throughout the day having these thoughts like, oh, I should probably make breakfast right away in case we have an alert and I have to go down and then I'll have 30 minutes of time that I'll be in the shelter and I won't be able to eat. And I find myself having those little thoughts because we were in quite some time, 6 weeks that we were in a war with Iran, and we were having sirens and missile alerts all throughout the day as well as throughout the night. And I started to reorganize my life based on how urgent the next priority was to try to get that done. And then even starting toward the end, thinking, okay, what items can I take with me into the shelter that I can do that it can happen while I'm in the shelter, and what things are stationary and only in my home? And a lot of it was cooking. And then I have to remember, I'm in a ceasefire. We don't have to run. I'm going to have the whole day that I don't have to run, so I can do my day. Have you related to any of those thoughts?
Not as much, but I would also live one flight of stairs from a bomb shelter, unlike you.
Yes, I have four flights of stairs, and I leave my... I go somewhere else for shelter. So
right, I don't know, you have to go to a different building.
I actually go to a different building. So I want you to take us through. We had an extension of the ceasefire, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so basically, you'll recall that during the first weekend of the ceasefire, Iranian and U.S. officials met in Pakistan. The U.S. delegation was led by Vice President J.D. Vance. And abruptly, the U.S. decided, after 21 hours of talks with their Iranian counterparts and the Pakistani mediators, that Iran was not serious, they were not interested in making a deal, and the U.S. packed up and left and went back to the United States. Now, the ceasefire remained in place, and there were back-channel talks between the two sides to talk about perhaps getting a deal, despite the fact that they could not come up with a framework of a deal while they were in Pakistan. Now, there were reports saying that the sides were close. These came from the United States. I'm not sure if this was, you know, President Trump trying to will a deal into existence, as he does in some of the other things that he's been involved with. He kind of says something and expects it to happen. The Iranians were pretty recalcitrant in this matter. And despite President Trump posting on Truth Social many times over the few days, the beginning of this week, that a deal was closed, the U.S. Delegation was on its way back to Pakistan. First they were going on Monday, then they were going on Tuesday, and it kept getting delayed and delayed until finally Vice President Vance, the flight was canceled, and it looked like we could be headed back to war. Now, it's unclear that a war was going to happen right away, but it seemed like there wouldn't be able to be a deal because Iran was steadfast in its position that there would be no talks so long as the U.S. blockade on the Strait of Hormuz remained in place. Now, when the Israeli ceasefire went into effect with Hezbollah last week, Iran immediately opened the Strait of Hormuz. There was a tweet by its foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, who said, you know, now that there's a ceasefire, this is one of the demands that Iran had. We're going to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to ships that were leaving the Gulf, ships that were not paying tolls to the Iranians. However, within 12 hours on Saturday, they closed it up again. It seems that the IRGC was like, no, not so fast. This is, we're giving the U.S. something for nothing. They're not lifting their blockade on our ships. President Trump was clear about that in the beginning, that he's not going to lift the blockade on Iranian ships leaving the Strait of Hormuz until there was a deal in place. We're not going to lift our blockade on non-Iranian ships or our ships that do not pay us tolls to leave the Strait of Hormuz. So that blockade came back into place. President Trump, however, kind of surprised everybody when Tuesday night Israel time, Tuesday during the day in the U.S., he said that per request by Pakistan, he is going to extend the ceasefire. He did not give a time limit for that. And he said he's going to extend the ceasefire to give Iran's disjointed government an opportunity to come up with a proposal, a unified proposal, because, as I said before, you've kind of have the IRGC, you've got the civilian government, you've got those who have a leg in both courts, like the person who's widely viewed as the de facto leader of Iran right now. He's the Speaker of Iran's Parliament, Mohammad Khalibaf. He's a former IRGC commander. Now he's the head of the Iranian Parliament. And he's like, come up with a unified proposal and get back to us. Now, it's a little bit unclear whether this is an actual issue in Iran right now, that the warring factions need to come up with some proposal that everyone's on board with. Yes, we do know that you have the hardliners in Iran who are like, we're not giving the U.S. anything. There are those who are like, listen, you know, our country's falling apart. Our economy is in absolute shambles. Let's make a deal here so that we can get on with this. But, you know, there was a report in The Economist earlier this week talking about how there is a real divide and kind of this push and pull among the various leaders in Iran. Then again, there was a report in CNN today that suggested that the leadership is not as fractured as we might think it is. Whatever the case, President Trump decided to give them time. Now, a report yesterday said that he's only giving them until Sunday to come up with a proposal. Then the White House denied the report and said there is no time limit on this. You know, the president will decide. Now, one of the things that could be, you know, the immediate question is, why would President Trump say there's no time limit, we're just going to have a ceasefire forever? Now, obviously, President Trump is under a lot of pressure at home. The war is not popular in the United States, and you know, oil prices are going up. But this closure that the U.S. has on the Strait of Hormuz is very important, and for a number of reasons. Number one, Iran already has an economy that is in the gutters, for lack of a better term. It's been under years and years of sanctions from the West. Its oil is unable to export its oil because of these sanctions, except to a few select countries, mainly China. And now, because of the U.S. blockade, it can't even export oil. And that's on top of the fact that...
Can we just pause about the U.S. blockade? I wanted to get into this earlier, and then I wanted to create a point system within the Israel Daily News for your vocabulary words, including recalcitrant, which we're gonna have to, you know, make like a document in the studio and with like gold stars on the side. We're gonna put them on for great vocab words. The U.S. blockade. The U.S. blocked, the U.S. brought in the a blockade because they were responding to Iran keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed, and there was I want you to take us through the back and forth negotiations and the timeline of how there were discussions of opening, closing, and then there was the leg of it where Iran said that Hezbollah was supposed to be a part of the ceasefire, and the United States said that was never on the table. Sure. So explain to us why the U.S. ultimately created a blockade after many volleys between in negotiations.
Sure. So when the war was kind of winding down before the ceasefire, there were a lot of back and forth, you know, mainly from Qatari officials who were trying to broker a ceasefire. And one of the requirements that President Trump set forth was that there would be no Iranian blockade on the Strait of Hormuz. Because remember, the last chip that Iran has, Iran could not defeat the United States militarily. Its military had been decimated. Many of its, other than its oil production facilities, its petrochemical facilities were destroyed. That was also a big source of income for the regime. And they were saying, you know what, the only pressure we can place on the United States is closing the Strait of Hormuz. And it's very easy for them to destroy the Strait of, to close the Strait of Hormuz, because despite the fact that their navy has been destroyed by the United States, to lay sea mines requires some speedboats. The mines themselves are very small, and also they can fire on ships. There's like this mountain range that is kind of on the coast of Iran overlooking the Strait of Hormuz, and they can fire on ships from there. So it's not that difficult for them to impose a closure. And when you have these large oil tankers carrying oil from Gulf states with a lot of cargo, very valuable cargo, the people on these ships are not going to be scared to go through, and their insurance companies aren't going to let them go through. The insurance companies will be like, hey, if you guys try to go through the Strait of Hormuz right now, your policy is dead, and we're not going to reimburse any losses. So they're just stuck in the Persian Gulf, unable to go through because of these reasons. And so President Trump said, okay, we're going to go to ceasefire on condition that Iran lifts the blockade. Well, guess what? Iran did not lift the blockade.
Right. And there was talks, they're going to lift it. They're going to lift it. And they did not lift it.
They did not lift it. So President Trump was like, you know what? Two can play this game. We're going to put a blockade on the Strait of Hormuz, and Iranian ships can't leave. Now, this is very important because Iran, like the only thing left that it has, keeping its economy alive, you know, keeping the regime alive financially, is its oil. And even during the war, they were able to export some oil. And now what this blockade is doing is it's not only keeping them from being able to export oil, which according to President Trump, it's costing them $500 million a day. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's definitely costing them a lot of money every day.
How much money?
He says $500 million a day.
Wow.
And now, they have this island, Karg Island, is a terminal through which 90% of its oil gets exported from. And there's a lot of storage sites for oil on this island. These storage sites are expected to be filled to the brim in about a week. And once that happens, Iran will no longer be able to pump oil. And the oil facilities in Iran will have to shut down. And that is significant because shutting down an oil facility and then starting it up again is extremely expensive. Because once it's shut off, they're going to have to unclog the oil. I don't know all the mechanics behind it, the engineering, but they have to like clean out all of the pumps and then restart it. And it's apparently a very, very expensive process. So not only will Iran not be able to export its oil facilities will have to shut down. And that shutdown is going to be a significant blow in and of itself to its economy. So I don't see President Trump. I mean, it makes sense that President Trump wouldn't necessarily end the ceasefire on Sunday, because he can keep putting pressure on Iran without military action here by keeping this closure on the Strait of Hormuz until Iran is forced to shut down its oil facilities, until Iran's economy gets into such dire straits that because it cannot get any more money from the export of oil, that it perhaps is forced to make a deal that is on the U.S. terms and not on Iran's terms. And that appears to be what President Trump could be trying to aim, be, aiming for, trying to achieve right now, because this is something he could do without military action. Again, it does have an effect on global oil prices because the entire Persian Gulf is closed because Iran won't let Gulf oil leave. U.S. won't let Iranian oil leave. And the only oil that's really being leaving that area is through Saudi Arabia's pipeline, that east-to-west pipeline, which sends oil through to the Red Sea, and that allows oil to be shipped out of the Saudi Arabia through the Red Sea. But I think 20% of the world's oil is pretty much stuck there, and that caused oil prices to go up, which in turn is not good for President Trump politically.
Do you think that President Trump really would prefer to deal with negotiations and deals versus military action?
Well, he loves the deal. He wrote the book, The Art of the Deal, and I think that he wants to be able to make a deal that he could sell to the American people. And not only does it need to be a deal that he can sell to the American people, he needs to be able to sell it as a deal that is much better than the 2015 JCPOA. That's
right.
The Obama-Iran deal in 2015. You know, after everything he has done, he pulled out of that deal, went to war over it. And
just for those that don't know, quick short explainer, the JCPOA, under the Obama administration, it was meant to curtail nuclear possibilities for Iran. Give us a little color on what that deal was, why Trump didn't like it. Israelis definitely didn't like it. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did a lot of research and presenting to try to convince American officials that that deal was no good. So just tell us a little bit about that for those who don't remember.
So in 2015, obviously, Israel was really bringing to attention the fact that Iran is on its way to nuclear weapons. Also, the United States was very concerned about this. There was a lot of intelligence showing that they had a secret facility in Qom that they were in a city in Iran using to enrich uranium and perhaps putting them on the path towards a nuclear weapon. So that kind of got the world involved. The world was also very concerned that Israel might bomb Iran. So they decided, you know, we're going to negotiate a deal with Iran. Because remember, Iran's under a lot of sanctions. And if we lift the sanctions, maybe Iran will make concessions on its nuclear enrichment and its nuclear program. So basically, a deal was reached in 2015. A deal that...
Under the Obama administration.
Right, and a deal that the prime minister was very much opposed to and campaigned against it, lobbied against it rather, went to Congress in the United States to campaign against it, to lobby against it. And ultimately, the deal put into place allowed Iran to enrich uranium up until something like 5% for civil use. It put a lot of safeguards in place for international inspections on Iranian nuclear facilities to make sure that Iran was not violating the terms of the deal. And also, Iran got a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars, opened up to them because they agreed to the terms of the deal. Now, Israel was very much opposed to this for a number of reasons. Number one, it didn't shut down Iran's nuclear program completely. Israel hadn't found intelligence that Iran did have plans, even though the plans were on ice for the time being, of building a nuclear weapon at some point. That was this stockpile of information that they were able to steal, the actual hard copies from
right. And then those hard copies were presented.
Yeah, the Prime Minister presented them at a famous press conference. And also, it had sunset provisions. This is the most important thing. That even if Iran...
It had what provisions?
Sunset provisions.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, even if Iran abided by all the terms of the agreement, within 10 to 15 years, all of the obligations that it has under the deal would end, would expire, and then there would really be no oversight on Iran in terms of it building a nuclear weapon. Now, obviously, the terms of the deal said that they could never build a nuclear weapon, but once all the safeguards in place expired, who's to say that they wouldn't build a nuclear weapon? And now they'd be able to do that after years and years of having tons of money pumped into their economy because the sanctions were lifted. And so President Trump pulled out of the agreement during his first term, and now, obviously, over the past year, there has been two wars so far fought in Iran in order to... The first one really was mainly to destroy its nuclear facilities, and the second war was really to weaken it militarily and also to finish whatever might have been left of its nuclear program. But as we know now, they have this large stockpile of highly enriched uranium, and that's one of the key things that the U.S. is trying to get out of Iran as part of any deal.
How much are we still dealing with missile launchers in Iran? Has Israel removed or decimated those launchers in Iran? Because those missiles, those long-range missiles that come from Iran to here, do major damage.
Correct.
And in this past war, we saw something that we weren't seeing so much of in the June outbreak, was cluster munitions, which sent these missiles that were opening up over the skies, making it more challenging for the IDF to shoot them down. And they were sprinkling bomblets across Israel, which meant that the damage was a little bit less, a little bit more specific onto one building. And what was shocking to me when I was doing my field work was in Ramat Gan, the place that I visited just outside of Tel Aviv, there was a bomblet that opened on the roof of a private apartment building that killed two elderly people. And the building looked fine. It was really just the top floor and that specific apartment that bomblet killed two people. So we know that Iran has capabilities outside of their nuclear power. How are we doing on that front?
So that's a good question. So during the war, it is believed that Iran's ability to rebuild missiles has been destroyed, and it would take them several years to rebuild the infrastructure necessary to build ballistic missiles. That is something that was not accomplished during the first war completely. Some facilities were destroyed, which were used to create some of the raw materials used to build these missiles. But now it seems that it does not have the ability to build a nuclear ballistic missiles at this time. They'd have to rebuild those facilities. However, it is believed that several hundred to about 1,000 of their ballistic missiles that could reach Israel have not been destroyed and were stored in underground bunkers that were not reached, as well as, depending who you ask, there have been multiple conflicting reports. Some reports say that Israel destroyed a lot of their missile launchers and also were buried a lot of the missile launchers, because a lot of these missile launchers and the missiles themselves were very deep underground, and the best Israel could do was destroy the entrance to these tunnels, but Iran could dig them out once the war is over. So how many of these missile launchers they have access to? I'd say the highest number that I've seen was a report in the New York Times not too long ago showed that they have access to 60% of their pre-war total of 470 missile launchers. And then the missiles themselves, Israeli reports said a few days before the war ended that they had about 1,000 missiles left. Other reports say they had a little bit more. At the beginning of the war, they only had 2,500 only. It's still a lot, obviously. But they used a lot of them to fire Israel at the Gulf states. Mainly, the United Arab Emirates was hit harder than Israel in terms of the amount of times it was targeted by Iranian missiles during the war.
Let's actually pause right there. Targeting the UAE, what is that? What's the message?
Well, the message was, I think it was kind of backfired on them. I think that what they wanted was for the Gulf states who are close to the United States to pressure the United States to stop the war. Because, like, hey, look, we don't want to get involved here. And it also kind of was like, hey, the U.S. has a base in Qatar, so we're going to fire at Qatar. Even though Qatar, as Sunni states go, they were probably on the best terms with Iran, if you could call them that, of all the,
sure,
the Gulf states, they fired on them anyway. And that had backfired because the Gulf states now are arguably closer to Israel than they ever were before because of this war, because they said, hey, we're on Israel's team against Iran, which is our common enemy. And in the Middle East, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
So, I have chills.
Yeah.
I have chills. But think about it, Binyamin. Yeah. I've been living in Israel since 2018. Do you think that in 2018 I ever could have thought that this would be our reality today, that we'd actually be in an Iranian war? I thought this was something that
the war with Iran was, like, as far as Israelis were concerned for many, many years, was kind of like this. There was this barrier of fear because Iran was
the big bad wolf.
I mean, they were a regional superpower, and for many of these Gulf states, who again are enemies with Iran, don't love Israel, but it was kind of like Iran kind of balances Israel out. Now they're like, no, we don't want Iran to balance Israel out. Israel is not a threat to us.
Which is
Iran
huge.
Iran is a threat to us, right.
Which is a huge, huge development, right. So, and a huge change.
And in one of the most significant developments there really is that barrier of fear of attacking Iran. Could the questions for many years, could Israeli planes make it to Iran and do all the refueling that it needs to do while over the skies of Iran and take out Iran's air defense systems? And one of the key things here was also the fall of the Assad regime. Mm. While Israel did have air superiority over Syria for many years, the Assad regime was allied with Iran. with them gone, the new regime in Syria, maybe not at peace with Israel. It's a Sunni regime that hates Iran, and so they're more than happy to see Israeli jets go and bomb Iran. So that was a huge loss for Iran. If we look at the last 3 years of war, you know, Iran has gone from being a powerhouse, not just as a country, but having all these proxies doing its dirty mm-hmm. work for it, whether it's Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, Houthis. You know, they themselves have been shown to be much weaker than they thought they were, or others or Israelis thought they were. Hezbollah is much weaker. Hamas is much weaker. Houthis are weak. So, and Syria's gone. They're wiped off the map in terms of being on Iran's side. And so, yes, in that sense, there was a tremendous victory. Now, it's not done yet because Iran is still in place, Hezbollah is still in place, albeit at a much weaker state. But as you pointed out, that there has been significant
geopolitical
progress.
Shifts.
Yes.
I would say that seeing the allyship from the UAE and from these Gulf states saying, hey, we're with Israel, is something that probably if you spoke to somebody who was building the country in 1948 or fighting, you know, in the underground and in the first years of Israel's creation, Israel has been fighting against all of its neighbors at all times for decades. And so to be in this place where there's kind of visibility from the UAE and visibility
so
from
the
these
UAE
places,
and Bahrain, recall they were in the Abraham Accords.
They were in the Abraham Accords.
But other countries like Qatar, which very adversarial towards Israel over the years, Kuwait, also an enemy entity. These are countries that, like, maybe quietly don't hate Israel as much as they did. And another thing we don't really talk about much is Hamas. Hamas had a straddle this line of, like, it's the one Sunni terrorist organization that is also in the sphere of influence of Iran. Iran is Shiite, and they don't really give money to Sunnis, but Hamas and Islamic Jihad, they did receive money from Iran because they had this common goal of attacking Israel. But Hamas also has headquarters in Qatar, and they're kind of trying to have their cake and eat it too. And once Qatar was attacked by Iran, they wanted Hamas, whose leaders are living in Qatar, to be like, hey, you're supposed to be against this. And they were like, we're not so against this because we can't be against Iran. Iran gives us a lot of money also. So now the Qataris are upset with Hamas. And again, how that plays out. But there are a lot of reports showing that Hamas is really trying to thread a line here. And they're walking on thin ice because not only are they under a lot of pressure from the United States and from Israel to disarm, the Egyptians are really sick of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Qataris are kind of headed up to there with them because the Qataris are like, listen, they'll be on Iran's side more before they're on our side. Why are we hosting them? Why are we being nice to them? And apparently, I heard this yesterday from a source. Even the Turks, who have also kind of been nice to Hamas over the past few years, they're kind of getting sick of Hamas's antics here. So it will be interesting to see whether this forces Hamas to be like, okay, we got to put our survival priority. You know, we'll make some concessions towards disarmament. Again, that remains to be seen. I mean, that's a topic for another time. But Hamas is going to feel the pressure as a result of Israeli and U.S. military accomplishments over the past weeks and years, as far as Israel's concerned. And we'll see how that plays out in Gaza. And then, obviously, the last thing we'd want to talk about is what's going on with Lebanon. Israel and Lebanon are set to hold talks today.
I have one more thing for you after the Lebanon, so it's not going to be our last one.
All right.
Please take us there.
So later today, Israeli and Lebanese officials will be meeting for a second round of talks in Washington. Again, these are talks being held at the ambassador level, so Israel's ambassador to the United States, Yechiel Leiter, and his Lebanese counterpart and U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, will be meeting in Washington at the State Department. The talks are being facilitated by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. There's not that much to discuss between the State of Lebanon and the State of Israel. There are perhaps some minor border disputes that can be worked out, but the main issue, the 800-pound elephant in the room, or 800-pound gorilla, or whatever they call it, is Hezbollah. And both sides hate Hezbollah, and at least the sides being represented by Lebanon, again, that's the Christians and the Sunnis, the Shiites are still behind. That's about a third of the population of Lebanon are behind Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is still a military force to be reckoned with as far as Lebanon is concerned. And I don't know how the country goes about getting rid of Hezbollah and disarming Hezbollah without external help, or, you know, is it even possible? You know, they're in every crevice of the country and they were given so much time to build up their military capabilities. How is that even possible? You know, what is the foreign minister, Guido Nsar, said this week that there are really no issues between us that can't be overcome. The only real issue is Hezbollah. And if Hezbollah were to go away tomorrow, we could have a deal with Lebanon in a matter of days or weeks, if not days. But Hezbollah is going to stand in the way of this. And one thing that Lebanon has asked, and we'll probably see a discussion about that, is the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah is set to expire on Sunday. Hezbollah is reportedly going to ask for a one-month extension. If Israel does grant it, it won't be because Lebanon asked for it. It'll be because President Trump asks for it, because he wants to work out a deal with Iran. But we'll see what happens with that.
And because he wants to work out a deal with Iran, and Iran has a responsibility over Hezbollah, they have been using Hezbollah as a part of their negotiations.
Correct. And as much as Israel and the United States have, for sure the United States have been trying to say, like, no, Lebanon is separate from Iran. We're not letting Iran represent Hezbollah in these talks. Israel has its own issue with Hezbollah. And Lebanon, the state of Lebanon itself, also saying, like, no, Iran has nothing to do with us. We're handling these negotiations ourselves. And Israel definitely doesn't want to combine the two. At the end of the day, Iran is using its influence over...
its proxy.
Well, not just its influence over this proxy, but it's trying to use that as leverage with the United States. And the United States' leverage over Israel, or relationship with Israel, to bring the issue of Hezbollah into the talks with Iran. And that's most likely why we saw President Trump pressure Israel into this 10-day ceasefire, because he doesn't want that getting in the way of any potential deal with Iran. Despite everybody's denials that Iran has anything to do with this, it seems that Iran does have what to do with
this. And let's face it, that's the point of Iran having Hezbollah. The point of Iran having all of these proxies is so that there's another leg to aid them in another place. So the fact that this is on the table of, oh, well, we're going to negotiate A, and A includes Hezbollah over in Lebanon, that's the point of having proxies.
Yeah, it's definitely a benefit to Iran for having them. I mean, the part of the proxies was to destroy Israel and to poke at Israel and to... But yes, it has definitely been a benefit to Iran in this situation, where they're like, okay, well, we also want you guys to stop fighting with Iran so that we can have, with Hezbollah, so we can have Hezbollah survive. Because Hezbollah is in a fight for its own survival. Much of its leadership has been killed. Much of its arsenal has been destroyed. And the Lebanese people, for years, they said, we're in place because we're the protectors of the Lebanese people. But they didn't need to protect Lebanese people, because Israel wasn't going to attack Lebanon unless it was attacked, and it was Hezbollah that was the biggest threat to Lebanon, to Israel, coming from Lebanon. And many, if not most, Lebanese people right now have gotten to the point where they're saying, we don't want Hezbollah here. We hate Hezbollah. They are destroying our country, and they're giving Israel reason to destroy our country. And that's what we're hearing from a lot of Lebanese who aren't Shiite.
If you would look at the front cover of the New York Times, you... as an outsider, would not have consciousness about this whole layered situation of Lebanon being a country that has a terrorist group living within its borders. The New York Times and countless other international media outlets have been highlighting Israeli strikes on Lebanon and making it look like, and not making it look like, using phrasing like, Israel is kicking out Shiites from Lebanon, and omitting that the reason that even the name Shiite is coming up is because this is a sector of the population run by Hezbollah or represented by Hezbollah. How do you respond to that? Because what you're talking about right now is something that you assume that everybody understands. So many of the papers are making it look like Israel is attacking Lebanon for the sake of attacking Lebanon, or for the sake of ethnically cleansing Shiites from the southern part of Lebanon. So how do you respond to that?
Well, recall that this last war with Lebanon began because it was Hezbollah that fired on Israel, and then Israel had to respond. So it was started because Hezbollah said that if the leadership of Iran was killed, we're going to step in. And that's what they did. So Israel's like, well, if you're going to step in, we're going to defend ourselves against you. And what we saw also during the war was that the residents of northern Israel were in this unbearable situation by which they had seconds, if that long, to find shelter because Hezbollah is so close to the border with Israel, they were able to fire missiles with very little warning time. So what Israel said, we're going to go into Lebanon, we're going to create a security zone so that even if Hezbollah is able to fire, they won't be able to fire this close to Israel and it will give more time to people to seek shelter and save more lives. And listeners might recall that between 82 to 2000, for most of that time, Israel maintained a security zone in southern Lebanon. During that time, people lived in the villages in southern Lebanon, and the vast majority of the population there is Shiite, very sympathetic to Hezbollah. And one of the reasons why it became so unbearable for Israel to maintain the security zone was because Hezbollah was able to hide among this population and conduct attacks on Israeli troops. And while Israeli troops were in Lebanon over the course of this past war and the one in 2024, reports said that troops went from house to house in many of these villages, and there was hardly a home they didn't find Hezbollah weapons in or Hezbollah infrastructure inside. And going into and so now when Israel's saying, okay, well, we're going to recreate the security zone, you know, and for the time being, that appears to be what Israel is going to do for the foreseeable future. They're saying we're going to make sure we have to go out and make sure that Hezbollah cannot come back into this space and rebuild the infrastructure that threatened the residents of northern Israel and indeed the residents of all of Israel, because they have missiles that can reach central Israel and even southern Israel. And so by clearing out this entire area and destroying the homes and the many of the homes that they did destroy, it's not only were they destroying Hezbollah infrastructure in the process, they're also not giving Hezbollah the opportunity to come back to these areas, even where the Israeli forces are located, and solving the problem that Israel had up to the year 2000, where there was a civilian population embedded among the Israeli military, and through which Hezbollah was able to hide and conduct attacks on the troops. In this way, Israel's doing what it did in Gaza, along the border, clearing out an area. The military is going to be there. We're going to make sure that Hamas cannot attack southern Israel. We're going to be in southern Lebanon and make sure that Hezbollah cannot conduct a physical attack or an aerial attack with missiles on northern Israel until we can figure out a solution for Hamas to be disarmed in the south, for Hezbollah to be disarmed in the north. And again, it's unfortunate for the civilian populations that live there, but at the end of the day, Israel has no choice because Hezbollah has taken full advantage, just like Hamas took full advantage of the civilian population in Gaza. Hezbollah is taking advantage of the Shiite population in southern Lebanon to conduct attacks on Israel, and that's unbearable for Israel or for any country.
If some kind of an agreement is come to between Lebanon and Israel, that will mean that Israel has struck normalization and peace deals with all, except for Syria, of its neighboring borders, and with Syria being a less hostile neighbor than previously.
Correct. I still think, though, any deal with Lebanon is far off into the future, unless by some miracle Hezbollah disappears or is like, hey, you know what, you're right, we're going to leave. I don't see how in the near future we have any sort of peace deal with Lebanon, so long as Hezbollah is still an entity to be reckoned with.
Well, we have to have hope. So I want you to tell us two things. One is, where do we stand today? What can we expect in the weeks coming up? And the other thing I want to ask you about is actually briefly about the Argentine president Milei coming to Israel and actually lighting a torch, and just what your response to that is.
Oh, I mean, so what can we expect in terms of Hezbollah? So
what can we expect in terms of Hezbollah and Iran?
In terms of Hezbollah, I would say it's probably more likely than not that the ceasefire gets extended. I think so long as there's no deal with Iran, President Trump doesn't want that added headache, and Israel will acquiesce as the man, so long as it has the freedom of movement to operate in the security zone that is established in southern Lebanon. Iran, again, I think we're going to know a little bit more in the next week or so once Iran starts to really feel the economic effects. On top of the economic effects it's been experiencing from years of sanction, on top of the economic effects it suffered as a result of the war. And again, Iran is going to want to salvage its regime on top of everything. And if that means making certain concessions with the United States, they might be so inclined to do that, though they have proven to be as even the U.S. has acknowledged, very tough negotiators, and President Trump might get frustrated and decide to restart the war. That's something we could probably expect in the next week or two. We'll see if Iran really is adamant and digs in, despite the economic toll it's taking on and the regime and its country, though they care less about the country than they do the regime, of course. As for the Yom HaTzmaut, the Independence Day celebrations, Javier Milei was known to be a very strong supporter of Israel, also a big Judeophile. He was known to study Judaism before he became president of Argentina. Apparently, he even said that he strongly considered conversion to Judaism, but decided against it because, as president of Argentina, he cannot observe Shabbat. So maybe something he would do after he leaves office. Also something else that happened over Yom HaTzmaut. President Trump, I believe he is the first non-Israeli to be awarded the Israel Prize for significant contributions to the Jewish people.
He is.
Yeah, and so he was awarded that. He was originally going to be here, but obviously because of the war, he wasn't able to make it. But at some point, either...
Well, but the president of Argentina made it, which I think is actually pretty nuts to hop on a plane and come to this country.
He lit one of the 12 torches of Yom HaTzmaut every year. There are 12 people honored with lighting a torch in honor of Independence Day. He was one of the 12, and he also put on a show. He sang a song in Spanish called Libre. And yeah, he was very well received in Israel. And President Trump will likely be formally awarded the award either the next time he's here or the next time perhaps the Prime Minister goes to Washington.
Well, that's fun. Thank you so much for taking us through all of that, Benjamin.
Thank you, Shanna.
All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Today is Thursday, April 23rd, 2025. Tel Aviv has a low of 15 degrees Celsius and a high of 20 degrees. That's 59 degrees Fahrenheit for the low, going up to 67 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, with a personal note from me at the top, you can sign up for that at IsraelDailyNews.org. Scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in so you can get on our mailing. We also ask you use our new donation page to send us a monthly contribution. Click on donate on our website to help us continue to produce our show. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.